somber President Joe Biden and First Lady Jill Biden visit the Hawaiian island of Maui, ravaged by the deadliest wildfires in the United States in more than a century.
I signed the Master Major Disaster Declaration that mobilized the whole of government response, which means whatever you need, you're going to get.
Plus, a rare tropical storm in Southern California brings more than a half an average year's worth of rain to some areas.
We have had storms in the past in the desert, and we get winds, but nothing like that.
And former President Donald Trump says he'll surrender Thursday in Georgia on charges tied to efforts to overturn the 2020 presidential election. Today is Tuesday, August 22nd, and this is VOA's International Edition. Good morning, I'm Lori London in Washington. President Joe Biden and First Lady Jill Biden on Monday toured the damage, met with survivors and emergency workers on the wildfire-ravaged Hawaiian island of Maui.
I want all of you to know the country grieves with you, stands with you, and will do everything possible to help you recover, rebuild, and respect culture and traditions when the rebuilding takes place.
Standing near a burned but still standing 150-year-old banyan tree, the president acknowledged the overwhelming devastation but said that Maui will persevere through the tragedy.
And this banyan tree, one called it the diamond in the rough of hope. Another referred to fire cannot reach its roots, what he said. Fire cannot reach its roots. That's Maui. That's America. And so the people of Hawaii, we're with you for as long as it takes, I promise you.
The wildfire nearly 2 weeks ago, the deadliest in the United States in more than a century, has taken at least 114 lives, while more than 800 people are still unaccounted for. Drenching rains from post-tropical storm Hillary flooded parts of the southwestern United States on Monday, as forecasters warned of life-threatening and catastrophic conditions as it moved inland. The first tropical storm to hit Southern California in 84 years stunned residents, as Hillary dropped more than a half an average year's worth of rain on some areas.
It was really scary. I mean, the winds were unbelievable, absolutely unreal. And the amount of water that came down was just out of this world. I mean, we have had storms in the past in the desert, and we get winds, but nothing like that.
Meanwhile, on Sunday, a moderate earthquake and aftershocks shook a large swath of Southern California as authorities braced for the tropical storm. There were no immediate reports of major damage or injury. And now forecasters are watching newly formed tropical storm Franklin in the Atlantic.
This one isn't a U.S. concern, but is a concern for the Caribbean region. We have tropical storm warnings up for Haiti and the Dominican Republic, portions of those countries. And it should move across that island of Hispaniola sometime Tuesday, probably Tuesday night period.
Speaking to the Associated Press, National Hurricane Center senior specialist John Cangialosi says the storm is forecast to drop up to 25 centimeters of rain. Authorities in Haiti and the Dominican Republic are warning residents to prepare for landslides and heavy rains. At least two people were injured on Monday when parts of a Ukrainian drone destroyed by Russian air defenses fell on a house in the Moscow region. Nearly 50 plane flights in and out of the capital were disrupted. And as Ukrainian forces continue their counteroffensive in the south, Russian forces are pummeling the city of Kupiansk in the northeast. VOA's Heather Murdoch reports from a city under attack as families evacuate and soldiers prepare for battle.
We are here in a military defense point hidden in the city of Kupiansk. The city in eastern Ukraine is becoming more dangerous by the day, with Russian forces attacking from a distance of about 5 kilometers. It is widely believed that Russia wants to recapture Kupiansk, and volunteers are evacuating families from frontline areas and nearby villages. Russia occupied the city for 7 months before Ukraine took control last September. Locals evacuating the area say they survived occupation, often without electricity, heat, or the internet, but now they cannot take it anymore. In an evacuation bus about to head out of town, Lydia weeps as she tells us that she knows she may never go home again. But at a church in the center of town, some residents say they will stay put until their homes fall down around them. About 2 hours after we visit the church, bombs crash into a residential area about 100 meters away. 10 people people are taken to a hospital. Soldiers say the city is strategic because of its railway hub, and they are preparing for a tough battle ahead. We are told in the coming weeks that these evacuations, now going on daily, could become mandatory. Reporting from Kupiansk, Ukraine, Heather Murdoch, VOA News.
The Economic Community of West African States, ECOWAS, has rejected a plan by Niger's coup leaders to relinquish power within 3 years. Timothy Obiju reports from the Nigerian capital, Abuja, on what steps West African leaders could take next.
The ECOWAS Commissioner for Political Affairs, Peace and Security, Abdel Fattah Moussa, spoke to a Nigerian television channel Monday. Fattah Moussa said the 3-year transition plan proposed by Niger's military junta was unacceptable, adding that the regional bloc ECOWAS insists on the return of constitutional order as quickly as possible. He said the junta proposed the transition plan as a distraction to remain in power for longer.
In some other countries under military regime in West Africa, they had about 3 years, and already they are negotiating with their population to have another 18 months. What legitimacy do they have, you know, to already begin with 3 years, and we know it is not going to end there?
In a televised address Saturday, Niger's junta leader Abdurrahmane Tchiani said the country would return to civilian rule within 3 years. He spoke soon after meeting with an ECOWAS delegation led by Nigeria's former head of state, Abdusalam Abubakar. Tchiani urged political parties to submit their vision for the transition within 30 days. He said, quote, "Our ambition is not to confiscate power. Transition period will not exceed 3 years," end quote. It was the first time the junta had met with ECOWAS representatives since the July 26th coup, raising hopes of continued dialogue. But Fattah Moussa says it is the pressure from ECOWAS sanctions and threat of military intervention that is making the junta more compliant.
We are no longer going to get into drawn-out haggling, you know, with people who have usurped power against their own constitution.
Idayat Hassan is the director of the Center for Strategic and International Studies, an Abuja-based pro-democracy think tank. She says ECOWAS must not give in to the transition plan by Niger's coup leaders.
Previously, putschists were never allowed to benefit from their push, as much as there is zero tolerance for unconstitutional change in government. If ECOWAS allows for this 3 years transition, it is going to be following in the footsteps of Mali and in Burkina and in Guinea.
Soldiers of the Presidential Guard, who deposed President Mohamed Bazoum last month, continue to hold him and his family hostage. ECOWAS recently activated a standby force to intervene in Niger if negotiations fail. Defense chiefs who met in Accra last week said they're ready to take action as soon as an order is given. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja, Nigeria.
Here are some of the other stories we are following from around the world. North Korean leader Kim Jong-un oversaw a test of strategic cruise missiles on Monday as South Korea and the United States kicked off annual military drills that Pyongyang sees as a rehearsal for war. International leaders are celebrating Guatemala's Sunday presidential victory of anti-corruption candidate Bernardo Arevalo, a win which had long seemed out of reach in an elections process shaken by accusations of government intervention. Russia and China will look to gain more political and economic ground in the developing world at a summit in South Korea this week, when an expected joint dose of anti-West grumbling from them may take on a sharper edge with a formal move to bring Saudi Arabia closer. This is VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
Scientists using data from the European Space Agency's CHEOPS mission learn more about an extremely hot and bright Neptune-sized exoplanet. The planet is called LTT-9779b. It's situated about 2.5 million kilometers from its host star, completes one solar orbit in just 19 hours, and is surrounded by metallic mirror-like clouds, making it the shiniest exoplanet found so far. CHEOPS shows knows the exoplanet reflects 80% of its star's light. By comparison, Earth reflects about 30% of the sun's light, Venus about 75%, but Enceladus, a moon of Saturn, reflects 90% of the light it gets from the sun. LTT 9779b was first discovered in 2020 by NASA's TESS Space Telescope. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Lori London. Donald Trump plans to turn himself in and be processed at the Fulton County Jail in Georgia on Thursday on charges of trying to overturn his 2020 election loss. That date was set during negotiations with the Fulton County District Attorney's Office on Monday over his bond and release conditions. Associated Press correspondent Sagar Magani has the latest.
Court papers show the ex-president's lawyers and Fulton County DA Fani Willis have agreed to a $200,000 bond. Trump was charged last week in the case with 18 allies, the fourth criminal case he's facing. As a condition of the bond, Trump is explicitly banned from intimidating co-defendants, witnesses, or victims, including on social media, whether through his own posts or reposts. Earlier in the day, he'd railed in a post against Georgia Republican Governor Brian Kemp, who rebuffed Trump's efforts to overturn the loss. Willis has set a noon Friday deadline for all the defendants to turn themselves in and be booked. Sagar Magani, Washington.
A Human Rights Watch report released Monday says border guards in Saudi Arabia have fired machine guns and launched mortars at Ethiopians trying to cross into the kingdom from Yemen, likely killing hundreds of unarmed migrants in recent years. Matthew Loratonda with Reuters reports.
Videos that have been verified by Human Rights Watch and analyzed by Reuters show several of them injured near the border between Yemen and Saudi Arabia. The rights group says Saudi guards used explosive weapons and shot at others from close range. Some of the videos show corpses and the digging of graves. Nadia Hardman is a researcher at Human Rights Watch and author of the report.
At Human Rights Watch, we've been documenting killings at the border by Saudi border guards of migrants and asylum seekers since 2014. But these were generally irregular. What we've seen is a dramatic escalation in the last few years. I can tell you that people told me that they witnessed, you know, killing fields, bodies scattered all over the mountain area, you know, people blown in half.
Mustafa Sofian Mohammed says he experienced one of the attacks firsthand. He says his group of 45 Ethiopians were near the end of a three-day journey to the border last July when machine gun and grenade fire erupted from Saudi territory. He lost part of his leg. He's saying that 2 years ago he went to Saudi Arabia through Djibouti, thinking that he would find a job to change the life of his family and his own. I came back to my family empty-handed and with only one leg, he says. A Saudi official said on Monday in an emailed response that the allegations from Human Rights Watch are, quote, unfounded and not based on reliable sources. Saudi authorities have also strongly denied allegations by UN officials in 2022 that border guards systematically killed migrants last year.
That was Matthew Loratonda with Reuters. As part of a five-year plan to develop East Jerusalem, Israel has opened a high-tech hub that aims to boost employment for Palestinians. It's the first step in a larger program to turn East Jerusalem into a local version of Silicon Valley. Linda Gradstein reports for VOA from Jerusalem.
Mahmoud Quais, the Palestinian founder of software company TechLinux, is one of the first tenants at East Tech in East Jerusalem, the high-tech hub that Israel recently opened in a bid to boost employment among Palestinians. All 10 of his employees are Jerusalem Palestinians, educated in Palestinian schools and colleges, whom he says face unique challenges integrating into the well-developed Israeli high-tech world.
East Jerusalem has their own unique burden on them because our market is limited into East Jerusalem. And if we want to expand to West Jerusalem or to Israel, we will need to build different skills, such as the Hebrew language, a different behavioral skills, culture, diversity. We need to know all of these things. And on top of the technical skills also that we need to match.
East Tech opened just a few weeks ago with 20 Palestinians from 5 high-tech companies. It's a project funded and run by the Jerusalem municipality and the Israeli government, and it aims to eventually bring in 150 Palestinians with high-tech degrees. East Tech also hosts a workshop in Arabic run by the NGO MUNA, which offers technology education to underprivileged youth. Einat Mesterman is the Jerusalem Municipality Program Director for East Jerusalem.
We are offering the companies that join us a full package. First of all, we are offering them to sit here in the building. There's no rent or any taxes that they have to pay. The place is for free. But they have to be hiring people from Jerusalem and to be in the field of technology.
Many Palestinians hesitate to cooperate with the Jerusalem municipality because it implies acceptance of Israeli sovereignty over all of Jerusalem. But some Israeli officials note that Jerusalem Palestinians are learning Hebrew and attending Israeli colleges and see that as a sign that many increasingly see a future in Israel. Linda Gradstein for VOA News, Jerusalem.
Despite some post-pandemic progress, closing global gender gaps and economic participation could take over 130 years. Participants at the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Women and the Economy Forum in Seattle also raised concerns about the disproportionate impact of climate change on young women. Natasha Moskovaya has more.
Countries in the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation, known as APEC, share a public commitment and numerous initiatives to address gender inequality. Yet, statistics discussed at the Women and the Economy Forum in Seattle this weekend highlight the amount of work that still lies ahead.
It will take over 130 years to close global gender participation gaps, and that we are 300 years away from gender equality, but also that closing the global gender gap in participation would add up to $28 trillion to global GDP, or nearly $17 trillion for the Asia Pacific. I don't have 300 years, nor 130. I'm getting impatient.
Chantelle Stratford, APEC Chair for Policy Partnership on Women and the Economy, warned that gains in gender equality are fragile, reversible, and cannot be taken for granted. One of the main topics on the agenda was digital inclusion, with its promises and risks.
I spoke to many women, just generally asked them the question of what are the challenges they face in their field, and inevitably, technology-facilitated harassment, online sexual abuse would come up in those conversations, which was upsetting. And in my current position as Ambassador at Large for Global Women's Issues in the Department of State in the United States, I want to really bring together technology experts to think about what are ways to increase women's safety, because technology is a tool that can offer women enormous opportunities.
Another concern raised at the forum was climate change and its disproportionate impact on women.
We're looking at a prediction that over the next decades, we're going to see 25 million to 1 billion people on the move. Now, what does that mean for young women? We know that after climate disasters, rates of violence go up against women, rates of unsafe abortion, rates of unplanned pregnancy. We estimate that over the next 20 years, that 14 million women will lose access to contraception. So when we think about this, about women on the move and how we can support their health care.
Y-Labs is a global design and research organization working on solutions to improve health and economic opportunity for young people. CEO Rebecca Hope told VOA she sees potential in employing technology to support climate resilience.
Options like digital sex education, digital access to ordering contraception, digital self-care for mental health. Mental health is severely impacted by climate disasters and climate change for young people. So I think there's opportunities to really innovate in the healthcare space to be able to offer young people more options in the way they access healthcare. It's not a replacement for traditional health services and health workers, but I think it's another tool in our toolkit.
While sharing many similar concerns, not all countries are on the same page with solutions or ready to implement them at the same pace. Sometimes it's about keeping the dialogue going. Natasha Mozgovaya, VOA News, Seattle, Washington.
And with warming oceans threatening much of the world's coral reefs, some ecologists are now using simple technology in hopes of helping restore them. VOA's Julie Tabot has more.
Coral reefs are in danger. Rapidly warming ocean waters is the main reason they're dying in record numbers. This disturbing trend has motivated some people to act. Joni Klepas is a coral reef scientist and director of Raising Coral Costa Rica. She spoke with VOA via Skype.
I've worked on coral reefs for a long time, mainly as a scientist, and I got really tired of telling people how bad it's going to be and decided to say, what can we do to make the reefs more resilient? And that's why we started this project.
Their project involves taking small pieces of coral from the wild and growing them in underwater nurseries for replanting on the reefs. The team uses simple technology to keep track of where the coral fragments come from to find the most resilient.
We're also distributing our corals to many more locations with things like temperature sensors and monitoring, just to make sure we are gathering as much information we can about where to put them in the future.
Restoration projects such as these are essential. By some estimates, the world has already lost 50% of its corals in the past 30 years due to global warming. If corals die, their disappearance will have a catastrophic impact on life both in and out of the ocean. Coral reefs protect our shorelines, maintain biodiversity in the water, and are essential to marine life. But for people like Klepas, it's also about keeping in place what's been in the ocean for millions of years.
They have a right to be here, and we have the obligation to keep them around and to build those pockets where they can survive, enough can survive so that they will rebuild into the future.
Another group that's helping to restore coral is ArchiReef, a climate technology company that's developed 3D printed terracotta reef tiles that can be embedded into strategic areas of the ocean floor as a substrate to help grow new coral. Dennis Tekarek is co-founder and chief commercial officer of the company. He spoke with VOA via Skype.
We place them with divers, we place them at the bottom of the ocean, and then we place coral fragments on top.
One of the benefits of the lightweight tiles is they can be moved to deeper, cooler waters as needed.
A diver can essentially deploy up to about 40 square meters in a single day by themselves.
That versatility has helped both projects achieve success as ocean temperatures continue to rise. In the words of renowned American oceanographer Sylvia Earle, the corals need the fish need the corals. If you take the fish away, the corals die. Take the corals away, the fish die. Julie Tabo, VOA News.
You've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, we thank you so much for joining us. Until next time, I'm Lori London in Washington. Be well, be safe, and have yourselves a wonderful day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
There is little doubt that the truce in Yemen, which came into effect in early April of last year, significantly improved the conditions in the country. The truce, originally meant to stay in effect for 2 months, was extended until October 2nd. But even after the agreement expired, hostilities have not returned to pre-truce levels, and civilian casualties are down. The sides continue to display general willingness to seek solutions, but this still needs to translate into concrete steps. In particular, a clear agreement on the way forward that includes restarting an inclusive Yemeni political process, said UN Special Envoy for Yemen, Hans Grundberg. Nonetheless, despite these hopeful signs, the developments in Yemen are a mixed bag of progress towards a political settlement and a reversion to fighting. On one hand, Yemen is experiencing the world's worst humanitarian crisis, with some 80% of the population in need of humanitarian aid. On the other hand, Saudi Arabia has just pledged a $1.2 billion donation. The United States welcomes Saudi Arabia's recent announcement of $1.2 billion in budget support for the Republic of Yemen government, which can help mitigate the worst consequences of the dire economic situation, said United States Representative to the United Nations, Linda Thomas-Greenfield.
But more attention and financial support are needed to address Yemen's economic and humanitarian crisis, especially at a time when the UN's response effort in Yemen remains grossly underfunded. Houthi attacks on maritime shipping are also exacerbating the humanitarian crisis. We strongly condemn these senseless attacks, which impede much-needed oil export avenues that fund basic services.
On the one hand, five UN staff members were recently released by an extremist group which had kidnapped them in February 2022. On the other hand, numerous others are still in captivity. The United States welcomes the release of the five UN personnel who were kidnapped in the southern governorate of Abyan last year, said Ambassador Thomas Greenfield.
Too many innocent people are still in detention, including wrongfully targeted individuals and religious minorities, as well as members of the United States locally employed staff who've been detained in Sana'a for over a year and a half. We call for the release of all those who have been unjustly detained, including 11 Yemeni Baha'i and Levi Mahabi.
Ultimately, said Ambassador Thomas Greenfield, only a durable and inclusive political resolution between the parties can ease the suffering of the Yemeni people.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.